Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have made national security a pillar of their campaigns. They both say they promised to eradicate ISIS. Hillary Clinton says she would intensify the air campaign in Iraq and Syria, step up support for local forces on the ground, and pursue a diplomatic strategy to resolve Syria's civil war and Iraq's sectarian conflict. Donald Trump says he would bomb ISIS positions and bar Muslim and Syrian refugees from entering the United States. One of today's guests, Andrew Bacevich, argues that Republicans and Democrats are united in their resolve that the United States must remain the world's greatest military power. He argues that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are different versions of hawks. So what will it take to rethink American foreign policy, and what should we expect from Hillary Clinton if she becomes the next president? Andrew Bacevich is a 23-year Army veteran who served in Vietnam. He's Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at Boston University, and his latest book is called America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks very much.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Eli Clifton, a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, where he focuses on money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. Hi, Eli. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So I want to ask both of you a general question. A couple of months ago, there was a very lengthy article in the New York Times Magazine by Mark Landler, and it's called How Hillary Clinton Became a Hawk. And he reports that throughout her career, based on what she has done, she has displayed instincts on foreign policy that are far more aggressive than President Obama and most Democrats. Andrew Bacevich, you have followed Hillary Clinton's policies very, very closely. How would you assess overall her foreign policy record?
Well, let me begin with describing what I think is her foreign policy worldview, which to my mind still assumes that the world is what it appeared to be roughly at the end of the Cold War. Recall that back in the early 1990s, the notion of the United States as the sole superpower was the conventional wisdom, the conviction that the United States had achieved something akin to military supremacy, and that military power was an eminently useful instrument in achieving our purposes in the world. These were commonplace notions, and I think Hillary Clinton bought them then, and I think she still subscribes to them today, which is another way of saying that she has not taken on board the remarkable changes in the world over the last 25 years, nor has she taken on board the fact of American military failure, particularly in the greater Middle East. So I think she's stuck in the past, and that doesn't make me particularly hopeful about what her approach to foreign policy will be should she become president.
She gave a speech yesterday to the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention. She shared her views on national security policy, and you either heard that speech or you read that speech. What did you think of it, and what did she say?
Well, not much. I mean, there was a string of cliches proclaiming that we are an exceptional nation, proclaiming that we have and must retain the world's greatest military, proclaiming that she is going to stand up to China, to North Korea, to Russia, and making virtually no reference to the reality of U.S. policy and what it has achieved or not achieved, what it has cost, not simply on her watch as Secretary of State, but more broadly during the Bush-Obama post-9/11 period. I mean, the reality is, I think we all recognize this, that the world is changing very, very rapidly, and therefore these old platitudes about American leadership strike me as utterly inadequate as responses to the moment. And speaking personally, that I'd like to hear a prospective commander-in-chief speak specifically and realistically about what the world looks like from her point of view, and therefore specifically about what U.S. policy ought to be in response.
Eli, you have written about U.S. foreign policy for many years. How would you describe Hillary Clinton's foreign policy worldview?
Well, I think that everything that's just been said is completely accurate in terms of how she's portrayed herself, and consistently the message that you get from her is that she perceives the global order as it is to require a militarily superior and engaged United States that is willing to project power, be it in Libya, as she proposed enforcing a no-fly zone in Syria, or taking a harder line against Iran, while still, according to her, supporting the Iran deal. I think the key distinction here, though, that the challenge in trying to understand where she's coming from, what her foreign policy beliefs really are, is that we can only really compare her to other people who have been commander-in-chief. She is, if nothing else, a master politician. And we know how she has run for office and how she has run against Barack Obama in 2008, and we know how she ran against Bernie Sanders over the past year. And in both cases, she has reused a number of the same lines of attack on her opponents. In both cases, she's accused both Sanders and Obama of, for instance, being too willing to negotiate or establish or normalize relations with countries that the United States has not gotten along with in the past. Cuba, from Cuba to Iran to North Korea. These are countries that it's very interesting to see these attacks being echoed again over the past year, the ones that she used against Obama, first for being too willing to say that he would sit down with countries that are perceived as at odds to United States interests. So certainly as a candidate, she has staked out a far more hawkish, far more cautious use of diplomacy than any other Democratic candidate. How that will play out if she is president, I think, is a very interesting question, and one that I don't have such clear answers to. Certainly, as a matter of policy of what she has done when she was Secretary of State, while she did push for intervention in Libya, she, as a candidate later on, she pushed for a no-fly zone in Syria that would have been quite difficult to implement. But at the same time, you know, she was she saw the early phases of diplomacy with Iran occurring, and according to a very recent and fascinating article published in the New Yorker by Connie Brook and coming up in the August 1st issue, she was actually one of the more realistic voices telling Obama early in his administration that he had to move fast on Guantanamo Bay and closing it because every 6 months that went by, it was going to get harder to do so. Hmm. And she may have been right about that.
Well, so I'm glad that you brought this up because I just really want to learn more about her record, what she has said. And so I haven't really heard this before on Guantanamo. So did she tell or did she suggest that Obama work hard to shut down Guantanamo?
Yes, supposedly in the years between 2008 and 2010, she was one of the more loud voices in the administration saying that if this was going to be done, it had to occur very quickly. And by the time the 2010 midterm elections came around, Republicans took control of the House. Her advice turned out, unfortunately, to be accurate, that it became much more difficult to gain any cooperation on the Hill in the matter.
Hmm. Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Andrew Basevich is Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at Boston University. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Today we are talking about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy record and what foreign policy would look like under a Hillary Clinton administration. And if you have any questions or comments, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So we have a record on what Hillary Clinton has done as Senator and Secretary of State. And Andrew, What are your thoughts? I mean, when we take a look at foreign policy after 9/11, would you say that President Obama, over the course of his 8 years, has really dialed down direct military intervention?
Well, I'd say he's tried to, or perhaps more accurately, he's modified the mode of military intervention. You'll recall that when he ran for office back in 2008, really the cornerstone, I think, of his candidacy in terms of foreign policy was his condemnation of the Iraq war, his promise to get us out of Iraq in a responsible way, and his contrast of contrasting description of the Afghanistan war as a necessary war, which he said that he was going to win. Sadly, as we approach the end of his presidency, it turns out that he has failed on both counts. We haven't ended the Iraq war. We maybe suspended it, but it's resumed and we're back in it. And certainly we have not won the Afghanistan war. And if indeed Hillary Clinton becomes the next president, President Obama will bequeath to her the same two wars that he inherited from President Bush, and that cannot be anything other than a great disappointment to Obama himself.
And I ask that because a lot of reports say that Hillary Clinton's foreign policy is more aggressive than President Obama. The New York Times, in that piece that I mentioned earlier by Mark Landler called How Hillary Clinton Became a Hawk, reports that her conviction was critical in persuading Obama to join allies in bombing Gaddafi's forces in Libya. In fact, Mr. Obama's Defense Secretary Robert Gates would later say that in a 51-49 decision, it was Clinton's support that put the ambivalent president over the line. Can you tell us, Andrew, what really stands out for you on Libya and Hillary Clinton's positions?
Well, I think that is the preeminent accomplishment, I use the term ironically, of her tenure as Secretary of State. It seems pretty clear that she was a major proponent of armed intervention. It seems pretty clear that she did so with the expectation that removing Gaddafi would facilitate the emergence of a stable, democratic Libyan government. And that's, frankly, that simply hasn't happened. What we end up with is anarchy. And I think what troubles me most is, unless I've missed it, I have not heard Hillary Clinton explain what she learned from her misguided promotion of that armed intervention. There's been, sadly, I think, there's been all this commotion about the Benghazi episode, and she's been targeted by the Republicans for partisan reasons. I think that the initial intervention in Libya to depose Gaddafi is a far more significant episode, and it really is the defining moment of her tenure as Secretary of State.
Eli, what would you add to that?
I agree completely that she so far has not answered for the decision to press for military intervention in Libya. It appears that she was very very much a true believer, as it were, in the people, the Libyan activists and sort of shadow governments, as they were wanted to portray themselves, who were meeting with her in places like Paris, telling her that there would be an outbreak of democracy if Gaddafi was overthrown. But what I really find striking in all of this is that she has tried to answer for her vote for the Iraq war, which is a war that in some ways was justified under similar, I mean, if you take aside the weapons of mass destruction argument, it was justified under many of the same arguments, that if we remove this strong man in the Middle East, there will be a liberal democracy that will flourish, that has been repressed, that has been, but that has been preparing itself to take over from abroad, and it just needs that extra push over the edge by the use of U.S. military to bring it to fruition. And it's the parallels between them and the fact that she has said that her vote for the Iraq war was a mistake, while not answering yet for the decisions and judgments she used in being what appears to have been a very influential force within the administration in pushing for U.S. Bombing in Libya under a similar set of beliefs and justification.
Well, and one of the reasons is because Libya doesn't get as much media attention in the U.S. I mean, a lot of people don't really even know what happened in Libya.
Absolutely, and not having U.S. boots on the ground in a significant number in the way that there were in Iraq, I think has largely kept it out of the headlines, and protected politicians who pushed for that intervention from having to answer for it in the way that they did with Iraq.
Well, and Andrew, this isn't getting much attention with the horrific refugee crisis, but the PBS NewsHour had a really awful but very well-reported piece about refugees who are fleeing Libya, and many of them are dying on their way to Europe.
There's been no accounting, and I think that the point made earlier is dead on. Generally speaking, the American people don't care about Libya. Generally speaking, the media has not given it a lot of attention, and therefore someone like Hillary Clinton can get away with not having to explain her thinking and to explain how she comes to terms or assesses the consequences of that intervention. So, again, I think it really it's a huge question mark with regard to her capacity to serve in office. You know, she's clearly smart. She knows her brief. She will never make the sort of verbal miscues that we hear on a daily basis from Donald Trump of saying things that are truly bizarre. But we don't get from Hillary Clinton, at least in my judgment, is a clear appreciation of how the world is changing and how, therefore, U.S. policy should also change.
Andrew Bacevich is Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at Boston University, author of the new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. We're talking today about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy record, what she would do if she becomes president. What questions do you have? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So I wanted to bring up Libya first for the very reasons we just talked about. It's just not getting much attention. A lot of people don't know the background. I also want to talk about ISIS because we have seen an escalation of ISIS attacks from Afghanistan, Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, in Europe. And now what's happening is whenever there's an attack, and this just happened in Germany when the young man went to a McDonald's and started shooting. I was watching the cable shows. And even before they have any facts, they connect it to ISIS. And they say it was not connected to ISIS in this case. But Andrew, the conversation around ISIS has become very simplistic in this country. We don't talk about what explains the rise of ISIS. Who is ISIS? And why do we have ISIS in the first place? Can you take that one first?
Well, I think that you are posing what ought to be a question at the very center of the presidential campaign, and I'd broaden it even a little bit more, that ISIS is not the problem. ISIS is a symptom of the problem, and there ought to be a real debate about what the problem is. People may disagree. I think the essence of the problem really is an internal crisis within Islam, and that crisis manifests itself in violence frequently directed against the West, albeit violence that has far greater effects on the people of the Islamic world itself. So what we ought to hear from Clinton, what we ought to hear from Trump or their surrogates is, tell me your understanding of what this phenomenon is, where it comes from, and what, if anything, the United States can do to try to protect ourselves from its effects or perhaps even to reduce it. And so the notion of elect me president and I'll get tough on ISIS may be necessary, but it really does almost nothing to address the larger roots that have given rise to ISIS in the first place.
Eli, what are your thoughts about that? Let's spend some more time talking about the roots of ISIS in the first place.
I think it's important to take that question even one step further in terms of the national discourse and start to have a discussion when we talk about possible policy prescriptions, be they military or otherwise, for addressing ISIS, to talk about also the costs and benefits of action versus inaction of any of these policy options. Now, just sort of to give a more concrete example of that, I think actually we started to get there very briefly during the Republican primaries when Jeb Bush attacked kind of haphazardly as being accused of his brother creating ISIS. Now that might be kind of a sloppy and, you know, very politically motivated hit, but watching, you know, him have a tough time in wrestling with this question and this discussion of what role might the U.S. invasion of Iraq have played in the development and the creation of this at that point unforeseen new element of ISIS. It was something that I don't think had really come up before in the national political discourse and debate. And that's something that I'd like to see brought back, maybe in a more sophisticated manner, when we talk about, you know, well, we're going to impose a no-fly zone. We need to have military intervention. Okay, well, what are the chances of success? What's the best case scenario here look like? But we also need to start talking about, you know, what are the possible repercussions? Let's talk these through a little bit more, and at least start to contemplate the possibility that that sometimes action comes at cost just as inaction does. And we need to start weighing these in a more mature way, because right now we've only been doing it in 2020 hindsight. And while that's important to do to better understand the roots of the problem, it doesn't bring us closer to having a really good, robust discussion about policy options going forward.
Well, it would be great to have that robust discussion. I can't even imagine what the debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are going to sound like. I mean, it obviously depends on how the moderators are going to handle it, but you can just imagine that we're not going to get much substance because, you know, I'm sure Donald will be incredibly rude. It'll just be sound bites. Andrew Bacevich, what about the links between the creation of ISIS and the invasion of Iraq? I mean, once in a great while, you will hear that discussed in the media, but it's pretty rare.
Well, I mean, Eli just described the some of the thinking as a little bit sloppy, but I would subscribe to the thesis that when the United States invaded Iraq, it shattered Iraq. And therefore created the conditions that allowed first al-Qaeda in Iraq to come into existence, and now that organization's successor, ISIS, to come into existence. So there is a direct causal link in my judgment, and now to get to affirm the argument that Eli was making, it seems to me that what we should want to hear from our candidates, Trump and Clinton, is their understanding of this process. I mean, the question would be, Secretary Clinton, Mr. Trump, please tell us what lessons we should learn from the Iraq War of 2003-2011, now having resumed, what lessons we should learn that would guide your approach to policy. Eli's quite correct. One of those lessons has to do with the unanticipated, unintended, deeply negative and costly consequences of embarking upon misguided wars. And sadly, Iraq is only one example of misusing American military power in that part of the world. And again, the cliches of American global leadership and American exceptionalism and the dangers of isolationism simply don't provide an adequate response to the record that we have been creating over the past decade and a half.
Well, after the break, I'd like to continue on this and ask you both about the Chilcot Report, which you've written about, Andrew. This was the investigation into the UK's involvement in the Iraq War. Andrew Bacevich is professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His recent book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation, where he covers U.S. foreign policy. Today, we are talking about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy record and what she would do as a president. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-7233. TALK. That's toll free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. 1/2 hour, it's BBC World Have Your Say. Amongst other things, they'll be talking about the shootings at the church in the north of France. That's on 91.7 KLW, just 1/2 hour from now.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about Hillary Clinton's record on issues affecting women and girls. She advocates for equal pay, abortion rights, expanding family planning, but some criticize her policies on welfare and foreign policy and how those affect women and girls. And then Thursday, as the Democratic Convention is about to wrap up, we will talk about the state of democracy in the United States. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, if you have any questions about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy record, what she would do as president, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Eli Clifton, reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation. Andrew Basevich is the author of many books. His latest is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew Basevich served in Vietnam. He's a 23-year Army veteran. Andrew, just quickly, I wanted to ask you, you wrote about the Chilcot Report for the Boston Globe. This was a very lengthy report, investigation conducted about the UK's involvement in Iraq, and it confirmed that George W. Bush, quote, decided at the end of 2001 to pursue a policy of regime change in Iraq, end quote. British intelligence officials already concluded that Iraq had played no role in the 9/11 attacks, and they found no evidence between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and they went forward anyway. You have said, like a couple other people have said, that for British citizens, this report makes for bitter reading, but they can at least console themselves with this. On the other side of the Atlantic, there's finally been an accounting. On our side, there's been zero, none, nor is there likely to be anytime soon.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the point we were making earlier, that the conversation about U.S. military policy tends to be a conversation about what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So we see that in the present campaign, Trump and Clinton are both going to tell us what they're going to do about ISIS, what they're going to do about the Syrian civil war. They won't reflect on prior U.S. military interventions anywhere in the Islamic world that have been going on now for 30-plus years to no particular useful purpose. What the Brits got as a result of the Chilcot investigation was at least some clear explanation for why the U.K. went to war in Iraq and why the U.K.'s participation in that war failed, did so little good. And I admire the fact that the British political establishment had the decency and the honesty to undertake such an accounting. I deeply regret that doesn't happen here. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen here is that when we look at the trajectory of U.S. policy in the greater Middle East, it's been a bipartisan project. Mm. Republicans and Democrats are equally responsible when you look at the longer narrative of how we got to where we are today.
And just what are your thoughts on Syria and how she'll deal with Syria if she becomes president? I mean, other foreign leaders, like, for example, in France, after that horrific man drove a truck into people in Nice and killed many, many people, a lot of people were criticizing the French government for saying we need to go bomb Syria. And they're saying, well, how is that going to prevent someone who grew up in France from doing something like this? He killed 84 people. I just wanted to get the number right. So what are your thoughts on that, Andrew? I mean, Syria on its own, and then how will she deal with ISIS in Syria?
earlier, her position was one of advocating increased U.S. support for the so-called moderate rebels, with an eye toward overthrowing the Assad regime and then the moderate rebels presumably establishing a moderate, stable government in Damascus. I think the flow of events has rendered that entire way of thinking obsolete. If there are any moderate rebels, they wield very little clout. The Syrian civil war is not a good guys against bad guys entity. Her inclination is to intervene and use force, given the complexities of Syria and the way it's entangled with ISIS, with Iraq, with Iran. I don't know that at this point whether she would be an advocate of more forceful intervention.
And Eli, what would you add? Meet the Press had a piece a couple weeks ago in which they quoted a former Obama administration official who did not want to be identified publicly. This person worked on national security, saying, quote, "I think fundamentally Secretary Clinton is tougher. This has been portrayed as more hawkish. And on some positions like Syria, she would have been more hawkish. But I use the phrase tough because I think the sentiment applies equally to negotiations with allies and adversaries alike," end quote. So what are your thoughts on what she would do, how she would deal with Syria if she becomes president?
I think everything we've heard from her so far about Syria has been very much in the context of being candidate Clinton and being on the campaign trail and trying to run as the more liberal interventionist or hawkish, or however you want to put it, a candidate in the Democratic field. And I say that sort of really focusing on, I believe it was October of 2015 when it first came out that she sort of broke with the White House saying that she was calling for a no-fly zone in Syria days after Russia had started a major bombing campaign and were probably some of the most active Air Force in Syrian airspace. And to me, that was just such a clear example of her promoting a policy that there was just no way that she would even try to enact if president. It was unrealistic. She's not looking to get into a shooting war with Russian aircraft in Syrian airspace. It was a policy proposal that purely sounded good in sound bites, but at least in my mind and in talking with other experts about it, I don't consider myself to be an expert on it, but in talking with military experts on it, it seemed like a policy proposal that was, you know, for lack of a better term, vaporware. It didn't exist. And I haven't heard a more sophisticated or a set of policy proposals from her on Syria that go much beyond that at this point. I have no doubt that that if elected president, she would be faced with far more real consequences and would be getting advice from the military and the intelligence community that would tell her that doing something like that is probably not a viable policy option. But beyond that, I find it to be actually a major open question is what her actual Syria policy looks like, or if she has one.
Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Andrew Basevich is a 23-year Army vet who served in Vietnam. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. We're talking today about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy record and what she might do as president. You can join us 866-798-8255. You can tweet at Your Call Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Philip in Brisbane. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and I'll try to be brief. My feeling is that regarding ISIS is that this has been brewing for a long, long time. It didn't just happen because Saddam Hussein's army was disbanded and they had nowhere to go. The root problem is poverty. And just as it is here, there are people like Trump who will take advantage of the poor and give them these red herrings, and people will follow leaders and join these disgruntled groups and take up arms, when the real root problem is poverty. People need jobs, and what leaders around the world and our leaders should be doing is focusing on getting at the root of the problem, making jobs for young people in the Arab countries, just as they should be doing it here, not focusing on who do we hate and who do we want to keep out and this and that. You've got to give young people hope, Now, remember, in the 60s, a lot of people went radical for very similar reasons, and it was foolish, and it was wasteful, and we're repeating it.
Hmm.
And that's my view.
All right, thank you. Andrew Basevich, your comment?
I couldn't hear him very well, but I think that he said the root of the problem is poverty and that the antidote is jobs. And in a very broad sense, I think I would certainly agree with that. Probably a lot of people would agree with that. But promoting economic development is a complicated business. If it were easy, we would have eliminated poverty long, long ago. Let's note that not all those countries in that part of the world need be poor. I mean, a country like Iraq has an abundant resources, oil, natural gas. They've not had anything like enlightened leadership locally. And so I think that I wish it were as easy as saying, let's just give them jobs. I think it's a heck of a lot more complicated. I think that our own misguided policies and our misuse of American military might has actually further complicated, created obstacles to serious economic development in the region.
Well, and the refugee crisis is just making this worse.
Yes.
Well, thank you for calling in. Philip, let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, yes, there's so many things that I wanted to say. First of all, I am very, very concerned about Hillary Clinton's support from AIPAC and her basically unconditional support for Israel, given the way that Israel has been continuously violating international law by putting settlements, by bombing Gaza, bombing civilians in Gaza, violating international war crimes, basically committing war crimes by bombing hospitals and schools. And so I'm concerned about that. But I'm also concerned right here in this hemisphere. Her support for Plan Merida, which is the plan that sends and weapon and arms the Mexican government, which the arms end up in the hands of traffickers and the corrupt officials, has basically resulted in the disappearance of 43 students. Also the killing of Mexican teachers, as well as since 2006, there's been 30,000 people disappeared in Mexico. So that is very worrisome. And on top of it, she had the very insensitive remark of saying that she would be sending the children that are coming across the border, that are fleeing violence, that she would send them back to send a message. What message was she planning on sending? That the parents shouldn't be sending their children to save their lives? This is something that the United States has created, also by the Central American wars in the 80s, and the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has destroyed the economies of Mexico, the peasant farmers. So what do people in the United States expect other people to do?
Well, thank you for that. I mean, you brought up a lot of things. I was just reading an article yesterday in the Daily Beast. At the convention yesterday, there was a huge, this is the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, a huge "No Human is Illegal" sign on stage as many immigrants took to the stage to talk about how they were afraid of being deported, all supporting Hillary Clinton. And I was curious to learn more about her policies on this. And the Daily Beast has a piece about how she has changed her views about the deportation of children. She now says she will not deport them, but we'll have to do another show on that. I mean, Eli, just quickly, there's so much attention on the Middle East. We're even guilty of this. We don't spend as much at all attention on Latin America, South America, hardly ever talk about Africa. We definitely need to change that. But these parts of the world aren't getting as much attention, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And I think that the connection between deporting illegal immigrants and the drug wars in Mexico and south of the border, they don't always get connected in terms of the discussion that occurs. Now, as you just said, Hillary Clinton has walked back her statement about deporting children, saying that she will not do that. At the convention on day one, there was a huge emphasis on immigrants and trying to push back against the anti-immigrant and frankly anti-border rhetoric that came out of the Republicans and out of Donald Trump. But I think that you raised some very good questions here, that we haven't heard any good, really good answers about what's going on south of the border and how U.S. policy and the drug wars have created this flood of in some cases refugees who are trying to escape violence, and that a lot of that violence has been a side effect or a product of the efforts to fight the war on drugs and to arm the Mexican government and other governments in Central America to engage in essentially a military conflict against the drug cartels. I think those are really good questions, and it is simply something that we haven't gotten good answers to at this point.
And to the point of our last caller, Lisa, there is a story, and we'll link to this, Foreign Policy in Focus, Hillary Clinton's Dark Drug War Legacy in Mexico. Clinton's State Department overlooked human rights abuses and corruption while keeping a lucrative flow of contracts moving to U.S. security firms working in Mexico. Andrew Bacevich, how would you assess Hillary Clinton's record in Latin America when she was Secretary of State? Did you follow that closely?
You know, I didn't, but could I go back to the reference to Clinton and Israel?
Sure. Oh, yes.
Because
yeah.
I don't want to skip by that. I mean, whether it's pandering to the Israel lobby or whether it represents her true convictions, she has elevated this notion of our undying and unbreakable friendship with Israel to new heights. I believe she said explicitly that as president, she would move the U.S.-Israeli relationship to the next level. That was her phrase. I don't know what that means, what the next level could be. But the point is, I think, that if she is true to her word, we cannot expect President Clinton to make any serious efforts with regard to ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She will not impose any serious pressure on the Netanyahu government. And by my reading, at least, the Netanyahu government has made it crystal clear that they have no serious interest in creating a sovereign Palestinian state. So if there were one thing, I think, that where Clinton has given us a clear understanding of where she intends to go, is that she intends that Israel should have an absolute free hand with regard to dealing with the Palestinians.
And Eli, you have written extensively about this. Yesterday, we did a show about who's funding the campaigns of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And Chaim Saban, an entertainment billionaire, has given Hillary Clinton super PACs $10 million. He's at the very top of her list. And in a 2010 New Yorker profile, he says he's a one-issue guy, and my issue is Israel. Many reports say that Hillary Clinton has done a lot to assure him that she shares his views on Israel. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, she wrote an open letter, or it appears to be an open letter. It's unclear how it became public, but nobody said it was a leak, in which she was addressed it to Chaim Saban, promising him that, among other things, that she would oppose BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, from Israel. And as U.S. institutions or states might want to pursue that as an option, modeling themselves after many institutions and pension funds, for instance, wanted to divest from South Africa in the 1980s. And I think that that's a very important thing, is the role that Chaim Saban's influence has had on her, the fact that his money appears to be focused on one thing. The other point I would make about Chaim Saban is that he's been giving $1 million a year to AIPAC. And AIPAC explicitly took sides against the Obama administration in their efforts to forge the Iran nuclear deal. Now, that raises kind of an interesting situation where she says that she would uphold the deal, but her biggest individual supporter seems to have helped fund some vicious attack ads on President Obama and funded the group that made the biggest push on Capitol Hill to try to whip Democrats to oppose the president on that diplomatic initiative. I think it raises some interesting questions about how far she will go to try to uphold the Iran nuclear deal. But also, you know, what exactly is Haim Saban's relationship to AIPAC, and what are his politics on these matters? What is he pushing for? He's a somewhat closed-off individual, but, you know, we've started to get some guesses here that, you know, he is uncomfortable with the Iran nuclear deal. He does oppose BDS, and he's not afraid to use his money to try to influence those matters, at least within the United States political spectrum.
Right, and the New Yorker profile is fascinating. It's very long, and if you want to learn more about him, read it. But they report that in 2002, Haim Saban contributed $7 million toward the cost of a new building for the Democratic National Committee, one of the largest known donations ever made to an American political party.
Absolutely. I mean, he's been ingratiating himself within the Democratic Party for years now. He clearly has a great deal of influence. And considering the amount of influence he has, we don't hear anywhere near as much about him as we do about Sheldon Adelson on the Republican side. That said, I think he's probably a more subtle individual. He doesn't like to draw as much attention to himself, but he certainly has Hillary Clinton's ear, and I think he probably has the ear of a lot of the Democratic Party's establishment.
This brings us to neocon support for Hillary Clinton. Foreign Policy reported a couple weeks ago that Robert Kagan, the co-founder of the conservative neocon think tank Project for a New American Century, who played a very leading role in pushing for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, was holding a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, and he did. The event raised $25,000 for Hillary Clinton. The Intercept has a piece. Just yesterday this happened. What are your thoughts on this, Andrew Bacevich? This piece is about how Robert Kagan and other neocons say that they are very anti-Trump and they are very pro-Hillary and they're going to work for Hillary Clinton.
Well, first of all, I don't think we should exaggerate the influence and importance of neoconservatives to include Robert Kagan. I think in many respects their influence peaked in the immediate post 9/11 period, and their fingerprints are all over the Iraq war, and the results of that war have diminished their significance in my judgment. But on this particular point, the neoconservatives are correct to see Donald Trump as a loose cannon, as somebody who should never get anywhere near the Oval Office and the responsibilities of Commander-in-Chief. And therefore, some of them, like Kagan, who I doubt had much regard for Hillary Clinton before the rise of Trump, now see her as the preferred alternative. And indeed, among Democrats, she is the Democrat whose views most closely resemble those of the neoconservatives. That she, like they, has this propensity to believe that American military power ought to be put to work to make the world a better place.
In this story by Rani Akalik at The Intercept, she went to this fundraiser last week. She quotes two rising stars in the Democratic foreign policy establishment, Amanda Sloat, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs. At this party, she said that Hillary Clinton will be more interventionist and forward-leaning than Obama has been in Syria. She also said that if Hillary Clinton is elected, she will escalate tensions with Russia, double down on the military in the Middle East and ignore the American public's growing hostility to intervention. What are your thoughts on this, Eli? It's also interesting to look at Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisors and who she's surrounding herself with.
Absolutely. I think that something, just to go back to what was being discussed about the sort of the shift of neoconservatives, I'd say there's two shifts that have occurred. There's been a massive exodus of them from being willing to support the Republican nominee, but then there's also been a number of them that have come out, so for instance, Kagan, to support Hillary Clinton. I think that it's important to look at the neoconservative movement, at least over the past 20 years, and about how they have sought to influence power or influence policy, in that they are very good at focusing on politicians and on administrations where they can have leverage, where they can influence the course of events. And, you know, they've had a good run of it with the Republican Party, with George W. Bush. They certainly had their own connections to the Clinton administration in the 90s. And I think that right now it's rather a no-brainer for them, since they promote intervention, that they would align themselves with Hillary Clinton and with people who are likely to be in her administration. When you hear the things that Donald Trump says, there's very little room for them to find any home in his Republican Party. Where things are in 2 to 4 years, I think, is a different question. But at this time, it makes total sense, and I think we'll see more of them. Either very prominently say that they are not going to vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, or a number of them will also be coming out over the coming months saying that they are supporting Hillary Clinton's candidacy, probably with the hopes of becoming advisors to her and influencing her either at the State Department or in the White House.
Hmm. Well, we will definitely continue following this. We've got a number of questions about how anyone can push Hillary Clinton, given that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren rarely talk about progressive foreign policy. So we'll definitely keep doing shows about these issues. Eli Clifton is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, covering U.S. foreign policy, and Andrew Basevich is a 23-year Army veteran who served in Vietnam. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. And Andrew, we'd love to have you back to talk specifically about your book. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss Hillary Clinton's record on issues affecting women and girls. At the 1995 UN Women's Conference, she said, "Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights." She advocates for equal pay, abortion rights, and expanding family planning, but some criticize her policies on welfare and foreign policy. So what does her record tell us? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.